Well, I've got best-selling author Robert Moss back with us. He was with me a few years ago. The Boy Who Died and Came Back. It's an incredible story, his story, and we'll be with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Moss, creator of The Active Dreaming, which is an original synthesis of modern dream work and shamanism. He was born in Australia. He survived three near-death experiences in childhood and leads very popular seminars all over the planet. And, of course, teaches training with Teachers for Active Dreaming, a former lecturer in ancient history at the Australian National University. He is a best-selling novelist, journalist, independent scholar. Here's Robert Moss back on Coast to Coast. Hello there, Robert.
Always good to hear your voice, George.
Likewise, I'm sure, with you. So where are you these days?
Well, believe it or not, I'm at home in the Northeast, not quite as frozen as it's been until recently. I'll be on the road to the West Coast again later this week, but for now, I'm at home in the Albany, New York area.
Well, good for you. What did you think of your homeland's efforts to try to find this plane? They were active in this search.
They were active. They were professional, weren't they? They showed concern and they showed efficiency and they were right on the job. And I think it was actually a model of how people should respond.
I know it. I hope they find that plane one way or another, whether, as some people think, it's on land or whether it's on the bottom of the sea.
The dreams that I've seen, and I'm not talking with any authority about this, but I've seen a lot of dreams about plane crashes before, during, and, you know, in the midst of this terrible thing. And they've mostly been about water and fire. So if I were to take the dreams as more accurate intelligence we're getting from anywhere else, who knows, I would say that based on the dream material, the plane did go down in the water and there was a fire of some kind in the cabin before it happened. Why that happened, how that happened, yeah. I couldn't possibly say. But those are the common elements in the dreams that I've seen that seem to relate to this. I've not dreamed of it myself, but in the dreams that have come to me over the transom, I would say that water and fire are the two dominant elements.
Three near-death experiences when you were a youngster. Three. What happened?
Well, we didn't have the phrase near-death experience in those days. We're talking Australia some time ago, George. I was 3 years old when it happened for the first time, and maybe I can give it a very short preamble. My mother had taken me to West Australia. We were on the East Coast to meet her Irish family there, and in particular her aunt, who we called Auntie Dick, who was an opera singer, the famous Dame Nellie Melba's friend and protege. And something of a psychic. I mean, a very gifted psychic. She kept quiet about it. She worked with a lot of famous people from entertainment. She may have done a reading for the Prince of Wales, the unfortunate Edward VIII who had to abdicate. She danced with him one night. I know that. Anyway, so here we are. I'm 3 years old, and Auntie Dick is doing the old-fashioned thing. She's reading the tea leaves, and she says something to my mother. I can't remember what. She looks in the teacup for three-year-old Robert. She turns white. She leaves the room. She will say nothing. And it was only years later that she revealed what she had seen. She'd seen my death. Well, you know, what kind of accurate psychic is this since Robert is talking to you on the phone? She was actually completely correct. I died that winter, in a terrible winter, down in Tasmania, where my father had been posted as an army officer. And the doctors pronounced me dead. I mean, as far as they could read things in those days, I suppose they didn't have full brain scans. I had no vital signs. They announced that I'd died, and then I came back. They're astonished. And I said to my parents, oh, your boy, he died and he came back, didn't he? So that's where the title of the book comes from, The Boy Who Died and Came Back. I cannot tell you much about what happened to me when I was out of my body, pronounced dead, age three. What I can say is that for years after that, I found it very hard to be in the body. I felt as if I was trying to operate an alien piece of equipment, maybe like my father's blocky old Holden automobile, you know, when you're a kid and you can't get your feet on the pedals, no one's giving you driving instructions. What I can tell you is what happened to me when I was nine. Are you game to hear that story?
I sure am.
All right. Well, this is a bit beyond many of the near-death experiences we've heard recently. I, by the way, am thrilled that people now find that they are welcome to talk about these things. When I was growing up in a conservative era in Australia, in a military family, it was not okay to say too much about these things. People got embarrassed. They got uptight. But here's what happened when I was nine. I rushed to a hospital in Melbourne for an emergency appendectomy. I had got used to not complaining of pain. When I said to my father I didn't feel great, he rushed me to the hospital. He knew that, you know, something was going on. My appendix was about to burst. So here I am, 9 years old, in the operating room. The knives are out. The surgeons are at work. The nurses are talking. And I'm out of my body under the ceiling. So far, this sounds familiar. I'm looking down at the scene of blood and mess and gore, and I don't want to be there. And I go out into the corridor in my my second body without quite being aware what's going on, and I see my mother grieving, and I don't want to be around her pain. I feel guilty for causing her so much pain and fear. I'm an only child, and I'm so sick all the time. I want to do, you know, normal kid stuff. I'm 9 years old. There's a famous theme park down the beach there in Melbourne called Luna Park. Its entrance is a great big round moon face, and the jingle is Luna Park, just for fun. I think, you know, I've lost track of the fact that my body's in the operating room.
Yeah.
I think I'll go down to Luna Park. I'll have some fun. I'll, you know, do the rides and not have to pay for them, look at the girls in their summer dresses, and I go through the moon face, and suddenly, George, I'm pulled down into a world that is different. It feels like a world inside the world, and the people are different. I mean, they're human-like, they're humanoid, but they're not like us, not exactly. They're very beautiful. They're very elegant. They're very tall. They're very pale. And they're loving, and they're welcoming, and they receive me as their own, and I seem to live a whole life among them. I seem to grow to manhood and become a father and a grandfather and be trained as some kind of elder or shaman. And I can still taste in memory what their food tasted like. I can still feel the love and warmth and the beauty of their surroundings. I seem to live a whole life in this world, and then, you know, that life is done, that body is used up, I'm going to go to my star home according to their teachings. But instead of going there, I find myself back in the operating room, back in the body of a nine-year-old boy, remembering. You know, this obviously shaped my opinions about reality. It shaped my understanding of what reality is, and it created a tremendous problem because you simply didn't talk about this kind of thing back then. I mean, my parents were very decent people. They were very supportive. They were very loving, but they had no way of understanding something like this. And for the doctors, oh, yeah, poor kid, he's hallucinating. It's the medication.
Sure.
George, the first person I met who could give me a model of understanding this kind of thing was a boy from the indigenous culture of Australia, an Aboriginal boy. He said to me something like, oh, yeah, we do that. We get sick. We go and live with the spirits. And when we get well, we come back, and sometimes we're the same and sometimes we're not. So this is the experience of feeling, believing that I lived a whole life out of my body when I died in a Melbourne hospital room at age 9. And it became a challenge. It became a burden. By the way, I wasn't miraculously healed physically. I continued to get ill. It's as if I continued to long for some world beyond this one. It was only after the third of these experiences, when I did not lose vital signs in hospital, but had something I think that can be responsibly called a near-death experience, that the healing came. So this is where it begins for me. And everything that I do now, and actually everything I've done all along the way, has been based on these foundational experiences. And the gift of them was to understand that there are worlds beyond the physical, and you know what? We can go there. Eventually, I learned that you don't have to go through the extremity of a near-death experience to learn about these things firsthand. I was able to teach people about that.
At this age of 9 years old, were you aware that this was happening to you, or did you think it was a hallucination?
It was absolutely real for me, more real than anything in the world around me. I went there, I lived a life, I came back, I was confused about who I was when I returned to that body. So it was absolutely indelibly real to me. And that was the difficulty, you see, because I couldn't talk safely about it to people around me. So there was a certain estrangement between me and my ordinary circumstances of not being able to talk about something which was of the central vital importance in my life. I guess if we'd been closer to my mother's Irish family, you know, the Irish talk about being away, you go away, you live with the other people and the hollow hills, the fairy folk or whatever, there might have been a sort of folkloric understanding. But, you know, we didn't have a model. I mean, in indigenous cultures and traditional cultures around the world, there are models for these things preceding our model of the near-death experience. I mean, in Tibet, for example, there's a term in Tibetan for someone who's done this. The word is delog, D-E-L-O-G. It means someone who's died and come back, and is recognized in that tradition, as in many indigenous cultures. The people do this, and they have a special challenge and perhaps a special calling. But I didn't, in my culture, growing up in a very conservative, white, mainstream culture in the 1950s, I didn't have people around me who could readily help me to understand what had happened. I'm very grateful for what Ray Moody did later on with Life After Life and bringing to our attention the fact that near-death experiences are not rare, they're not weird, they go on a lot. We now have millions of people who claim to have had them, but I didn't have any of that body of evidence or data or scientific talk in the 1950s as a kid in Australia.
No, he coined that phrase, and that's when people really began to become more aware of this.
he did us a Raymond Moody did us a tremendous service, and I honour him for it. And by the way, he gave a wonderful blessing to my book, The Boy Who Died and Came Back, which you could see on the cover and inside. He gave us a way of talking about these things that is responsible. He collected data very carefully to show how widespread this phenomenon is. He traced common elements in people's experience, and he helped us to understand that it is from the accounts of survivors of this kind of thing that we have one of our ways of knowing something of vital importance in any life. That is that consciousness, soul, spirit survives physical death. That is something that we want to know about firsthand. It's not something we want to take on trust. It's not something to be debated or argued about. We need firsthand experience of this, or the next best thing, which is the accounts of people who have gone there and come back and can talk about it with the authority of their personal experience. And Ray Moody made it very clear to us that this is what we need, this is what he'd gathered, and gave us that incredibly useful phrase, near-death experience. But having said all that, George, in my own mind, I am still the boy who died and came back, yeah, rather than an NDE survivor.
And I'm glad you came back.
Thank you very much.
Later,
probably mixed opinions about that in some quarters, but I'm glad to have you say that.
Later on in life, you moved to a farm in New York, and it altered your life. It changed your life. What happened?
It did. Well, I mean, this was another experience of dying and coming back. We're not talking about losing signs in a hospital this time, but we're talking about going through a life change that is so radical that you feel in the midst of it and then at the end of it that you are a different person and you have the challenge again of putting yourself together. I was a best-selling thriller writer back in the 80s. You know, I'd get on an airplane and six people would be reading my current thriller, Moscow Rules, Carnival of Spies, one of those. And I didn't like it. I mean, it sounds like everybody's dream, but I was bored. I felt that some of these books I think are pretty good, but my creative source wanted me to do something more. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll find some land in a more rural environment, put down some roots in my adopted country and see what wants to happen. So in a synchronistic way, because of a white oak tree and a red-tailed hawk, which is a pretty good story, but I won't go into it right now, I bought a lot of land, or a lot of land by my standards, in the upper Hudson Valley of New York on the edge of traditional Mohawk Indian country. And, you know, I sat down to finish the historical spy novel I was working on, and then I thought, well, maybe I'll write a book about the American Revolution, novel, thriller elements. And I discovered in my wandering researches, I discovered an interesting character from the colonial frontier. His name was William Johnson. He became Sir William Johnson, an Irishman who came to America to make his fortune, was adopted by the Mohawk Indians, lived like a tribal king, became king superintendent of Indians, and arguably the most powerful man in the American colonies in the period of the French and Indian War. I became interested in him. I began researching his life. Eventually, I went to his birthplace in Ireland. And as I embarked on this historical investigation of a figure who is largely forgotten in American history, I found something extraordinary happening. This might interest those of your listeners who are interested in our connection with past lives, future lives, other lives, all of that. I found myself being drawn into scenes from his life. I mean, I could go there. In my dreams and visions, I felt I was there. And I found dramas, relationships, other stuff from his life coming into my waking reality. But the most important thing was this. I found myself in a visionary way in direct contact, mind to mind, with a Mohawk Indian shaman, woman shaman, mother of the wolf clan of her people, who tried to influence Johnson in the early 1700s, tried to shape his mind for the benefit of her people, with mixed results, and certainly succeeded in reaching to my mind and influencing me. She taught me things about dreaming, about what we would now call remote viewing, about healing through vision that went beyond what anyone in my culture had taught me. And none of this happened without, you know, some challenge, some spiritual emergency, to use Stan Grof's terminology. And by the end of it, and I guess it never really is an end to a life story like this, I found that everything that I'd thought had been important in recent years when I was the top of the bestseller list and running around living like a lord didn't really matter to me anymore. What mattered was the heart of understanding how dreaming, in a more generous sense than we use the word in Western culture, can help people to get through, can help them to get in touch with their soul, can help them to heal. So eventually, you know, not without lots of mistakes and lots of errors and lots of U-turns and ups and downs, I embarked on the path that I now follow, which is somebody who is a dream ambassador and dream teacher who helps to bring back ancient ways of seeing and understanding into our world. But I've been very frank in this book, and in some ways this part of the book might be the most relevant to many readers, about the cost, the risk, the drama, the difficulty of changing your life as completely as I was led to do in the late 80s
would
and the
you,
early 90s.
Robert, would you do it again?
Would I do it again, the whole thing again?
Yes.
Well, probably the short answer is yes. If I did it again, I would like to carry some knowledge that would prevent me from going through the delays and making some of the mistakes that I made. I mean, in a parallel world, and there are perhaps infinite parallel worlds, including one where you and I aren't talking and one where I continue to be a best-selling thriller writer, we might have exercised different choices. If I did it again, George, I would love to go with enough memory of where I went wrong to waste less time on the delays. But then, of course, the delays and the errors become part of the story, don't they? I mean, I'm convinced as a writer, you know this too, that if nothing goes wrong, you don't have much of a story. So maybe some of the things that went wrong, which I've written about rather frankly in this book, are part of the story which has come out probably reasonably well so far.
Buy Amazon.com stock when you know what you should have done a long time ago.
Well, there's that too, isn't there? There's that too.
So, but now you're really a dream teacher now, aren't you?
Yes, I spent half my time traveling the world, I mean literally from Bucharest to Brazil, holding really exciting seminars where people go deep. I mean, they learn to travel in the way of the shamans with the aid of drumming. I mean, we're chemical-free, but we use drumming. They learn that you can do a lot more with your dreams than just sit around and yak and analyze them. You can take a dream that you remember as a gateway through which you can journey, you can travel to do something really interesting, to have an adventure, to have some fun, to go beyond a terror, to clarify information that can save your job, your relationship, or even your life, and that you can go on adventures with other people. There's a lot of interest in lucid dreaming these days. Well, I teach lucid dreaming, but I teach techniques that are both more advanced and more simple and colloquial than a lot of what is on offer. I teach people how any night you can embark on a lucid dream adventure by hanging out in the twilight zone between sleep and waking. That's an everyday colloquial approach to lucid dreaming. And I teach people how by using some simple shamanic devices, like choosing an image as a portal, as a gateway image, and using drumming, monotonous or fairly monotonous shamanic drumming as a source of fuel and focus, you can go on a wide awake conscious or lucid dream adventure, and hey, you can do it with other people too. You can do shared dreaming, you can have adventures with a whole group of people. In my workshops, we might have 30 or 40 people going on a agreed journey together to have some fun, gain some knowledge, achieve some healing, and bring back results, data they can confirm and verify by talking it over together.
People who do not remember their dreams, Robert, do they lack something? What's wrong?
Well, I think we're in a state of bad habits in our society. I mean, our culture doesn't reward people for remembering dreams, and so a lot of us let them go because we don't have good social habits. I mean, in some indigenous and ancient societies, the first game of the day is to sit down with the right people, or maybe your family, maybe a special advisor, a special friend, and share the take from the night and give each other some feedback. I mean, I've invented a very simple way of doing that, and if you've got an incentive like that, you've got someone who's waiting to hear your story and share a story like you, that already changes your habits. But then there are lots of people who are very dry, I mean, in a state of drought in relation to dreams. It has something to do with our sleep patterns, our artificial sleep patterns. It has something to do with medications and sleep aids. It has something to do with being awakened artificially and hurriedly with the alarm clock or someone waking you up. It also has something to do with hope and fear, George.
Hope and fear. Stay with us. We're going to come back. Robert Moss, as we talk about his latest work, The Boy Who Died and Came Back. Well, our television program is called Beyond Belief, and you can watch it for free for 10 days, and then you take a look at all the other videos while you're looking at it and take advantage of that. Just go to this website, beyondbelief.com, and if you haven't done it yet, there's a link at coasttocoastam.com for beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Robert Moss with us. Robert, so you're talking about dreams giving people hope. Let's get into that.
Well, we're actually starting to talk about why people are lacking dream recall, why a lot of us are going through a dream drought in our culture.
And a lot of people
and
are.
I said that paradoxically, one of the reasons why many of us shut out our dreams, slam the door and don't want to hear from our dreams is hope or fear. What do I mean? Well, the fear is pretty easy. You think that something bad is coming up in your dreams. You'd rather not think about that. Maybe it's a dark side to yourself. Maybe it's a future possibility, sickness, relationship problems you'd rather not look at. So you slam the door and say, gee, I don't want to think about that. Hopefully it's just a dream. But hope is another thing. You know, we see something wonderful in a dream. We see ourselves with, you know, Mr. Right or Ms. Right, you know, the partner who would fulfill us, the soulmate. We see ourselves in this wonderful house, and then we wake up and think, well, I can't have that. It's just a fantasy. So we close the door and kiss goodbye to the alluring possibilities and hopes in our dreams because we think we can't manifest them. But both reasons for closing the door on dreams are foolish and short-sighted. If you see something in your dreams which is worrying you, you ought to take a good, hard look at it because your dreams might be prepping you for something in waking life which you can handle much better. It might be showing you a road accident or an illness or a relationship problem. You can navigate much better or avoid altogether by harvesting the dream information and doing something with it. And you know what? If you see something wonderful in your dream, some beauteous possibility of love, life, money, abundance that you think you can't have, well, think again, because if we dream it, we might just be able to do it. You know, dreams do show us roads in life that the ordinary mind has failed to notice. When people say to me, okay, well, this all sounds good, but, you know, I'm still not catching any dreams, I make a number of suggestions, and some of them go beyond what we are commonly told. For example, I'll say to people, take a nap whenever you can. I mean, see if you can get two periods of sleep in a 24-hour cycle rather than just one. That's the way our ancestors dreamed and slept. That's the way humans dreamed and slept until quite recently in our evolution on the planet. And I think people tend to do better in terms of dream recall if they have more than one sleep period. I mean, one can be quite short. So take a nap and see what happens. And another thing I say to people who are missing out on their dreams, missing the movies, is don't kiss goodbye to fragments. You've just got the tiniest little wisp, a sense of color, a bit of music. You wake up with a soundtrack and you might play with that. It's interesting. It could be guidance in its own right. It could help you to bring back more of the dream. And then the fundamental thing I say to people who are lacking their night dreams is, hey, the world around you will speak to you like a set of dream symbols, signs, messages, through synchronicity or meaningful coincidence. Pay attention to what's going on around you in the everyday world and learn to look at it as something like a set of symbols. We need to be more symbolist about waking life and more literalist about dreams. It's fascinating what happens when people start waking up to the way that the world is speaking through synchronicity.
It would seem that people who do not recall their dreams are missing out on something. What is that something, Rob?
Well, they're missing out on the multidimensional universe, George. In dreams, I mean, look, let's put it like this. Dreaming, whether we're talking about sleep dreams or whether we're talking about meditation or shamanic or lucid dreaming, in dreams we get out there. We go beyond the body and the brain. I mean, this is no secret. People talk about OBEs and so on. It goes on every night. Every night, everybody in a sleep dream will travel beyond the body and the brain. Where do you go? Well, take a look. Start remembering. You might go to a parallel universe where you see yourself living the life you might have lived if you'd made a different choice or known to buy Amazon stock, to quote you, at the right moment.
Yeah.
You might go into a past time or a future time. You might see the future. You might go to the realm where the dead are at home and learn firsthand that the dead are, of course, alive somewhere else and learn about the rich geography of the afterlife. You might go to a place of adventure, education, training, initiation, and healing. All of this becomes available when we wake up to the fact that we can travel in mind and consciousness beyond the body and brain at any time. We can do it right now. We don't have to go to sleep to do this. But sometimes we are so benighted and so closed to our multidimensional identity that it is in dreams, in sleep dreams, when we put down our ordinary inhibitions and our dull, repetitive skepticism and just go and do it, that we come alive to the nature of the larger reality. And beyond all of that, George, you know, dreaming is one of the ways to get to the larger story of your life. Often we're living just a sort of picayune little story, a story put together by family and other people's expectations and our own limited aspirations. One of the things going on in dreams is that our larger story, our larger life drama comes hunting us, looking for us, trying to bring us awake, trying to make us live with a bit more courage and passion. I love this. I love seeing people getting a sense that there is a larger purpose to life, and one of the ways that they do that is by waking up to what their dreams are giving them.
What creates the dream, Robert? Is it the physical brain or is there something else, the subconscious?
The physical brain's like, it's a good question. The physical brain's like a transceiver. I mean, many of my friends are physiologists and neuroscientists. They do all that work on the brain. But, you know, to try and understand where dreams are made by looking at the brain, although it's necessary because if the brain isn't working well, you probably your reception isn't very good. To try and understand the source of dreams by pulling the brain apart is a bit like trying to understand what's going on with your TV screen or your computer monitor by just pulling apart the computer monitor or the TV without looking at how transmissions come through, with the studios where the programs are made, the scripting process and all of that. I mean, in dreams, we go out there, go beyond the body and the brain. We get into the realm of mind. And you know what? Mind is not in the brain. Brain is in the mind. So, you know, all sorts of things go on in dreams. They're not the same. There are big dreams and little dreams. There are dreams that are processing dreams. There are dreams that the Hawaiians, who have a rich tradition of dreaming, call wild goatfish dreams. Now, goatfish is something they eat. A wild goatfish dream is a trash dream. It might have been caused by something you ate or something,
sure.
some passing mood. Just throw it away. It's a trash dream. Don't bother with that. But then there are dreams that are true dreams. They are veridical dreams. They are memories of the future. We travel ahead of ourselves in dreams, and we come back with information that we can use to make better choices. And we encounter others in dreams, and we encounter the larger self, maybe, the spiritual teachers, the authentic teachers who are looking for us to bring us awake. So when you become aware of this panoply of possibilities available in dreaming, you might begin to come around to my way of thinking, which sounds very paradoxical to people who are unused to talking this way. My way of thinking is this. Dreaming is not fundamentally about what happens during sleep. It's fundamentally about waking up to the larger multidimensional universe and becoming a multidimensional being.
So underneath the main title of your book, The Boy Who Died and Came Back, it's Adventures of a Dream Archaeologist in the Multiverse. Explain that.
Yes, well, the book is an adventure story, as you know, and it's not only the adventure story of my own near-death experiences. It's my adventures as somebody who travels the world, goes to different countries, goes to different landscapes, gets caught up with the traditions, the ancestors, the mythology, the situation of those countries, and uses these techniques to do some good. I mean, for example, in Eastern Europe, which we're all thinking about these days, I mean, I travel regularly to the Baltic, Romania, the Czech Republic, Prague. I teach there, and sometimes they're ancestral problems. They're historical problems. These are countries in what Timothy Snyder called the bloodlands. I mean, sandwiched between Germany and Russia, a geopolitical tragedy to be in that situation. And I work with people there to get in touch with authentic traditions of those countries that they can use today to heal their relations with the ancestors. And what does dream archaeology mean? Well, it means bringing together skills and arts of several different kinds. The skills and arts of a shamanic dreamer. That means someone who will work with dream clues and follow them, that odd word, that detail, that clue to something that might be significant, and can learn to travel consciously, lucidly, shamanically in dreaming as a singleton or as a member of a group to get good information. Combining that with the skills of the scholar, the historian, the anthropologist, the archaeologist, and a little bit of the detective. To do what? Well, for example, to know exactly what a certain tradition is all about. To know what happened in a certain place in a certain time, to know what in a country's mythology is worth tapping into today, to know how to communicate with the wise ancestors and how to get the kind of ancestors who bring you down through the history of violence and hatred and addiction, how to get those ancestors off your backs. So, you know, I tell this not as a matter of theory, but in a series of rather gripping adventures in this book, full of thrills and spills.
If you know how to use your dreams correctly, you probably can do some amazing things.
Yes, you can save your life for a start.
Save your life, better a career.
I couldn't be talking to you today if I hadn't, to my certain knowledge, avoided a date with death in three probably fatal road accidents three times by harvesting the dream information and using it to avoid those dates with death. I mean, the first of them was when I was a war correspondent back in the Vietnam era. And the war just spread to Cambodia, and I'm in a hotel with a hotshot war photographer, and we're going to go out on the road on a jeep, in a jeep. And I, out of that terrible road out of Phnom Penh, and I dream of death on that road, something like a heavy mortar shell hitting the jeep. And I say in the morning, we're not going. This is the dream. He says, you're wimping out. I didn't go, and he did, and I'm alive, and he's not.
Oh.
Pretty simple. Pretty simple.
Oh,
huh?
My gosh. These precognitive
dreams. So, you know, I know
dreams.
That this stuff works. I have a friend whose son was deployed in Afghanistan in the Marines, and he said, Robert, my son has asked me what is the most important thing I can tell him as he prepares to go on combat service in Afghanistan. And my friend has studied with me, shared dreams with me. My friend said to his son-in-law, a Marine lieutenant, he said, listen to your dreams, they can save your life. On his first week on patrol in Afghanistan, according to my friend, the son-in-law is, you know, going out on patrol, and he dreams the exact location of an IED in his dream, and he's in a landscape he's never seen before. They're out on patrol. He recognizes the situation. He stops his men. They search the area, and they discover three IEDs in the exact location that he had scouted in his dream before he got there. So, you know, George, real men are dreamers, too. And I notice, I mean, I've had some history as a war correspondent and in other situations with men and women in dangerous areas, in harm's way. I notice that the people who do best are using gut instinct, they're using intuition, and yes, they're using their dreams in a way that a lot of people forget to do.
These precognitive dreams, and of course, there are so many different kinds of dreams, and you touched on lucid dreaming, but with precognitive dreams, which you've had quite a bit, you've just cited a few examples of those. What creates it, Robert? I mean, how does it seem to happen?
Well, I think it's as simple as this. I think that in dreams, in intuitive travels, if you like, which might be during sleep or might be in other ways, you can travel ahead of yourself, part of your consciousness. Traveling with or without a second body, a subtler energy body, travels ahead of the physical body and scouts out the ways. I think this is part of our human survival kit. I think it's always been with us. I think every night, whether we know it or not, we are traveling ahead of ourselves, looking at the possible future. Now, we talk about precognition. You understand perfectly well as I do what that means. Precognition is when you see something of the future that then comes to pass, manifests. I mean, that's interesting, but once you've clarified for yourself that is for real, that you can do precognition, you can then proceed to do the more interesting stuff, which is not simply to see what's going to happen, but to see possible futures that you can alter for the better. Let me give you the most simple, everyday example, boring example, right back at the beginning of this practice. So I dream that I'm going to speak in an auditorium on a very hot day, and the air conditioning is so loud, the fan is so loud, no one can hear me. So we've got the option of either opening the windows and roasting, turning off the AC, or me being inaudible. So I think about the dream. I think about what college this could be. It's one I can get to from my house. I drive out there. It's going to be a summer lecture. I have them turn on the AC, and it is exactly as seen in the dream. So I have my lecture moved to another auditorium. That's a very simple, boring, trivial example of an early warning, an early advisory, which when you harvest the information, you can make better choices and come out better. And our dreams can show us wonderful things of the future that could manifest if we'll take some action, get ourselves together, and do something about it. Part of the reason I call my approach active dreaming is this isn't just another method of analyzing or verbalizing dream information. It's a program for action. It's a way of getting in touch with sources and resources we often neglect, which can help us do better. And it requires us to get the information, get it straight, get it clear, and then take appropriate action to use that information in everyday life.
What if you don't recognize it, and it's right out there, it's so obvious, but you just don't pick it up?
Well, we're all going to go through some learning bumps, aren't we? And on your way to becoming, let us say, a future dreamer, which I'm playing with because I don't want to say simply precognitive dreamer, because it's about more than just precognition. It's about picking up early advisories, early warnings, early opportunity dreams. On your way to becoming someone who has a very active engagement with the future, you're probably going to make some mistakes, fail to recognize certain things, and learn from them. And you'll learn that you missed messages for a variety of reasons. For example, you got a symbolic message and you didn't think it could be related to a literal possibility. Example, for the last 6 months, I've been dreaming of Stalin. I've been dreaming of Stalin again and again. These are very deep, very rich dreams, as if Stalin is still around. They're also like time travel dreams. In one of them, I'm back in 1943, and in my dream self, not my regular self, I'm going to a table deep in Russia, close to Ukraine, where Stalin is sitting down to lunch, and I'm trying to remember the right thing to say, and I say something like, eat it up, gobble it up, devour it. And when I woke from the dream, I thought, oh my God, I hope this doesn't mean that something like Stalin, some one character who wants to eat and gobble and devour is going to emerge on the political spectrum today. My dream that seemed to be both a mix of time travel, you know, and I'm a historian, and symbolist might have related to, might have been prescient about things developing in terms of people gobbling up other people's real estate in Eastern Europe today. So we also miss messages because we are in a different perspective in our dreams. Psychic dreamers within families, for example, or in groups of friends, often find themselves entering, this is interesting, into the perspective of someone else in the scene. So they're seeing a certain drama. It's particularly characteristic of women, women with close friends or sisters or daughters. They somehow seem to enter the perspective and situation of someone else in the family or circle of friends, and sometimes it's hard coming out of the dream to discern what relates to the dreamer and what relates to someone else in the scene that the information might be about, who could use the information. So there are all sorts of reasons why we muddle dream messages about the future, and the answer is always the same. It's practice, practice, practice.
What about the dreams where the dead visit you?
Well, there's nothing weird or supernatural about this. You've looked into this deeply, too. I know. I've written several books about this, and the new one is full of many examples of talking to the dead who are still alive. I've done it all my life, actually, I guess, and having been among the dead, I suppose I'm one of those who is naturally prone to do this. The dead who are alive, the deceased, the departed, come calling on us for all the reasons that we call on each other in regular life, and then some. They might need help, or they might want to give us guidance. They might want love or forgiveness. They might want an update on the family. Sometimes they turn up in dreams and as presences in the environment because they never moved on. They're still around. Sometimes they're still around because they think we are clueless and need some help from them. You run into that particularly with overprotective mothers after they've died. They want to stay around and help the kids to get things straight. They might be around because they need another drag, another puff, another drink, another fix. You know, that they're still addicted and they haven't shaken that off. And so, you know, this kind of interaction with the departed is in no way weird or supernatural. It is beyond the common understanding of what is natural and common. But in fact, I would hold that these encounters with the deceased are entirely natural and very common. And one of the reasons is there are lots of people on the other side of death who very much want to talk to survivors, who very much want to talk to people
on
this
side. For a number of reasons, right?
For a number of reasons, exactly. For a whole list. You and I can make a much longer list than I gave for all sorts of reasons. I mean, when my first wife's father died, he'd been a journalist and professor in Australia, as I had. He would turn up we'd sit down together as if we're a couple of Aussies having a beer and going through the newspapers. And he wanted to show me things in the newspapers 6 to 9 months into the future. Yeah, he was focused on Southeast Asia. I was living in London at the time that these things were happening. So I'd be looking at headlines relating to things that might happen in New Guinea or Indonesia 6 to 9 months into the future. It was very interesting. There wasn't very much I could do with it. I think he thought that it would be useful to share his information about the possible future with someone he knew who might be able to do something with it. Well, I couldn't do very much with it, but I noticed that his reason was informational. He wanted to play a reliable source of information. I wouldn't call him a spiritual guide or a spirit guide. I mean, that was Jeffrey. I'd had very good relations with him. He wanted to share things of the possible future because this is very important. Because our dead, our deceased, when they get clear, have knowledge of the past and the future across time from outside time that often eludes those of us caught up in the confusion down here.
They could help us. We're coming back with phone calls with Robert Moss on Coast to Coast AM.